Hello and welcome to Radio EduTalk. This is David Noble in Dalgety Bay, and for the first part of this evening's show, I'm delighted that we've got Neil McLennan on the phone. Good evening, Neil. Could you just tell us a little bit about yourself?
Hi, David. Yes, absolutely. I am one of the co-chairs at the Young Academy of Scotland, which was set up by the Royal Society of Edinburgh in 2011. My day job is a quality improvement officer in education, and this is a voluntary civic society role that I undertake.
Okay, and I understand that there was a recent project that the Young Academy of Scotland was involved in, and yourself particularly driving it forward, and it took the title of its title was a hashtag with aspirational advice. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
That's right. So one of the working groups who have been most active within the Academy of Scotland has been the Excellence in Education group. And they've responded to a number of issues facing education, interdisciplinary learning report that they produced, also a great deal of work on numeracy counts, video resources following SSLN. But a recurring theme coming from educators, those within the education world, has been the issue of aspiration and how do we get young people to dream big and to really raise their aspirations that they can aim high and achieve great things. So the Young Academy, using its interdisciplinary membership, using its ability to access a number of areas of Scottish society and international society, drove forward a Twitter campaign, and it was really asking people from across Scotland, indeed across the world, to share with young people what was the piece of advice that made you, as a young person, as a child, aspire and dream big and aim high, or indeed, when you look back, what was the piece of advice that you wish you'd got now that you're looking back with the wealth of experience from within your own life?
Okay, and do you feel it was successful? You know, did you manage to get sort of many famous people from the entertainment industry or civic society in Scotland to take part?
Absolutely, absolutely. No, the campaign was an outstanding success. I mean, the response that we got from across Scottish society and internationally was just phenomenal. And yes, there were celebrities and people of note in there, but it was interesting. It was just a broad range of inputs from Scottish society. I mean, a few of the statistics behind it may be of interest. We had a total of 717 tweets that were issued during the period from January right up until the first SQA exam in 2015. There were 699 retweets and in total 413 participants. And in total, using analytics, it looks as though 4,500 engaged in the campaign, and we followed it up with campaigns in schools as well. And two of the things that were really nice in terms of impact: one was hearing that schools were printing up some of the pieces of aspirational advice that were being circulated and started to post them around the school in advance of SQA exams. So hearing schools doing that was really nice, that they were taking that into their own school domain. And then obviously we had the schools competition as well, where we asked young people to comment themselves on what pieces of advice most inspired them, most took their imagination. And out of that, we had three schools winners who all received revision textbooks from Leckie and Leckie. Stirling High Enterprise Team were one of the early recipients. And then we then had a young girl who was part of a community girls football club. And then lastly, Northfield Academy, who really engaged in the campaign as part of their overarching motto of aspire to be outstanding. So it was really nice to hear that the 4,500 engagements and hits, if you like, that we had over that period of time really drove down from, as you say, journalists, international figures, right the way into school communities and down into individuals.
And just finally, before we introduce listeners to one of the famous contributors, are you going to try something again along these lines, Neil, or you know, are you going to repeat the the whole project again as we come into the maybe the exam diet next year? Or are you going to take the lessons from this and make it even bigger and better?
Absolutely. So a couple of things in the back of that. I mean, as you say, one of the folks who really grabbed the imagination, actually was the most popular tweet, was our guest who's coming on in a second, and we'll hear more of him from a second. But the top five that we had Craig McEwen, a professional boxer. We had one of our members, his own tweet about mental health challenges was very popular. We had a Commonwealth Games high jump athlete, and we had the ambassador from the USA to Britain. His tweet was also made it into the top five in terms of popularity. So that's a broad range of people who their messages were of interest to young people. So the whole purpose of it was to kickstart a country into rethinking again about, you know, what is aspiration? How do we raise aspiration? What sort of advice got you inspiring? And what sort of advice helps young people to aspire? So it certainly kickstarted something, and we'd certainly like to continue the campaign again next year. I guess the important thing is what people then do with that. And once they've given a bit of advice, how do you then follow up? And even if it's just started to get people thinking in their own minds, how is it that we really tap into young people and get the best for our young people within this country, that's a real success, and it's certainly worth repeating.
Welcome to the second part of this EduTalk, special EduTalk broadcast, and I'm delighted to welcome on to the show Scottish author Ian Rankin. Welcome to Radio EduTalk, Ian.
Hiya.
And I'm still joined by Neil McLean of Young Academy of Scotland, and we're just talking a bit more about the Aspirational Advice campaign that ran earlier on this year. Just to maybe kind of expand, Ian, on your own contributions to that particular project, can you just give us a flavour of your own educational journey and what your aspirations were, you know, back when you were kind of 15 or 16 years old?
Well, I mean, I grew up in a working class family in a wee coal mining village in Fife. I was the first member of my family to do hires or go to 6 year or indeed go to university after that. And, you know, my parents, they were solid working class. They'd left school at 14 or 15, been through the war. You know, it was one of these families where the pay packets were opened on a Friday night and money was counted out a wee bit for the insurance, a wee bit for the summer holiday, a wee bit for Christmas. They were always very cautious people. And I think they thought, oh, Ian's brainy, he's going to go to university, he's going to come up with a career. The original plan was that I would go to university and study accountancy and economics. Neither of which I was particularly interested in, but I had an uncle who was an accountant down in England, and he owned his own house and he owned a car, and he was about the only person I knew who owned their own house and had a car. So that was what I was going to do, until I had this epiphany after my hires when I was 17, and I suddenly decided, no, what I really want to do is study books. I want to study literature. So I had to break it to my parents that, in fact, I wasn't going to apply to uni to study accountancy and economics. I was going to study English. I think they were a bit bemused and slightly horrified. They said, what kind of job will you get with that? I went, well, I'll probably come back to Fife and be a teacher or something, but I'll be doing a thing I'm interested in and something I'm passionate about rather than something I'm just doing for a paycheck.
And Neil, just feel free to come in at any point. I'm just wondering, looking back at your own experience of kind of sort of formal secondary and primary education, Ian, you know, was it a positive experience for you? And where did the kind of inspiration and the ideas and the creativity come from within the education system, if indeed it did?
Well, I was kind of blessed to have several very good English teachers in a row. Right up through secondary school. You know, and it wasn't just rote learning, which I'm afraid tended to be the way things were in the 70s in Scotland to a large extent in comprehensive schools. It was, you know, I mean, I remember one teacher in particular, Mr. Gillespie at Beath High School, Cowdenbeath Senior High, and he would give you Paul Simon lyrics and Neil Diamond lyrics, and he would say, right, we're going to study these as poems, this is poetry. So things that were kind of in the mainstream, things that as a teenager I could relate to and connect to, suddenly it was okay to like them. You know, it wasn't just a kind of, there was no elitism or snobbery about him. And that was great. And of course, I happened to be in high school at the time of punk. And punk was very important because what punk said was, just go on and try it, give it a go. It doesn't matter if you've got no ability, just get out there and do it. If you want to do it, do it. And when at 18, I joined a punk band and I was the vocalist. And of course, I was rubbish, a terrible, terrible singer. But you know, it was just that punk said, there's nothing to get in the way. If you want to do it, go and give it a go. And that was, you know, I was wanting to be a writer. And with that in mind, I thought, well, I'm just going to write stories and send them off, write poems and send them off and see what happens. I'm not going to be embarrassed about it. And I'm just going to do it and see if I get anywhere with it. And, you know, after many rejection letters and years of knockbacks, eventually it came good.
I think a couple of things that come out of there, you know, are really interesting in terms of wider debates and discussions that are going on within education. And one of the things you touched upon was following your passion. That came through a number of times during our aspirational advice campaign, advising young people, find something you really enjoy and you're more likely to be successful in that. But there's always a challenge in there of parental pressure. What would your message be to parents and how would you influence parents to really tap into what is it a young person wants to do and let them pursue that dream?
Well, I mean, speaking as a parent, or you know, I've got two sons, one's 23 and one's 21, what you want as a parent, the first thing you want is for your kids to be happy and healthy. And everything else is secondary to that. And, you know, they're not going to be happy if they're just plowing along, doing stuff they're not very interested in just for a wage or for the promise of a wage at the end of it. So you should be open as a parent. I think most parents are open to their kids doing anything that makes them happy, as long as it's legal. You know, anything, any sort of career path or any path in life that's going to bring joy into their life. And because, you know, we don't give happiness enough credit. I mean, people who are genuinely happy in their work or happy in their life tend to be healthy as well. I mean, it's very good psychologically for you. And I'm afraid that a lot of kids these days are getting worked harder and harder. They're getting tested more and more. They're having to do more and more homework. There's less and less time for them to actually enjoy life. And somebody a while ago was saying, you know, one of the things that's gone missing in life is time when you do nothing, time when you get bored. It's like every single moment of the waking day has to be filled with stuff. You know, you're on your phone checking your messages, checking the internet, checking Twitter, doing this, doing that. Back in the old days, the 60s and 70s, when I was growing up, there were periods of time when there wasn't very much going on. And those were the times when you used your creativity, you used your imagination. You filled in the gaps in your life with your own, you know, with your own thoughts and your own stuff that you wanted to do.
Mm. And do you think some of the information technology devices that young people use perhaps stifle that by taking up time with them on that rather than thinking time and time for creative imagination?
Well, I think there's pros and cons. I mean, the internet has been a boon in all kinds of ways. I mean, if you wanted to be a writer, for example, you know, 20, 30 years ago, you'd go and write, how do I get started? What do I do? I don't know anybody that's doing it. How do I get published? Are there any magazines out there? Are there any outlets where I can get my stuff published? Well, now with the internet, you go straight on there, stick something in Google, and before you know it, you've got writers' groups, you've got online magazines, you've got people giving you advice. You can self-publish, you can do whatever the heck you want, and there might be a readership out there waiting for you. So the way of getting noticed as a writer has changed. The internet has been a boon, I think, for a lot of people who want to write, and feeling part of a community and not feeling quite as isolated as they would have felt a generation or two back. Mm-hmm. At the same time, you know, it can make you lazy, and it's. I mean, I go on Twitter a lot. I'm a bit of a Twitter junkie. And my wife will say, well, you've been on Twitter for an hour. What's going on Twitter? And I'll say, oh, I don't know, because I'm just skimming it. It's information without knowledge. It really doesn't stick in a way that reading a book sticks or going to a class and speaking to somebody sticks. It's stuff that you can skim and you're kind of partly paying attention to it, not always paying attention to it. And so it can be dangerous in inverted commas because it can kind of make you lazy in a way. And if I'm doing research on a project, I always try and do it face-to-face if possible. It's much better to seek out an expert and sit face-to-face with them than just to go on Wikipedia and see what you can find about your chosen subject.
I'm wondering, Ian, you know, back in the 60s and 70s, to what extent were other aspects of your local community supportive of what you were trying to do with your life? And does that sense of community or support from the community, has that continued to be important right up to maybe sort of digital networks and communities nowadays?
Well, I mean, I grew up in it was a very tribal place. It was a wee village and everybody knew everybody else and my family were all there. I had an auntie and uncle over the back fence, an auntie and uncle two doors away, an auntie and uncle round the corner. So it could feel a wee bit claustrophobic if you felt different, and it didn't do to stick out from the crowd. So if, like me, you felt different, you kind of hid it away and you tried to blend in, you became a chameleon. And I mean, I wasn't telling my family or even my friends that I was scribbling down poems and song lyrics and stories. I was just doing it in my bedroom and keeping it in a folder or in a jotter that I'd stolen from school, a series of jotters stolen from school, and, you know, tucked under the bed and never telling anybody about it because I didn't think people would understand. And it was only when I got to university that I suddenly realised, oh, look, I'm surrounded by people who are interested in the same things I was. So having felt a little bit isolated in my home village, when I got to university and joined the Poetry Society and various writers' groups and got interested in the university newspaper and the Film Society, writing notes for the monthly bulletin and that, suddenly we found the people that had the same interest in me. And really, that was hugely encouraging to have people, to actually have a peer group at last and not having to be a chameleon so that your true self could emerge, as it were.
One of the things that's really interesting is that touching on inspirational teachers, and I think it's a core component of education. Doing well is for us really inspiring teachers in a classroom who've hooked a class, individual young people, and led them to success. And literacy standards continues to be a sort of headline issue. What are your own thoughts in terms of how we get reluctant readers to engage in reading, and even better, to also go on and become young writers?
Well, a few years ago, the Labour Party in the Scottish Parliament set up a kind of working group on literacy, and they invited me to join that working group. So I spent a couple of years going to meetings and listening to experts and gathering their thoughts on what would help. And it was mostly to do with young men. It was to do with kind of kids, boys leaving primary school, 11, 12, 13, and just basically stopping reading. For some reason, when they get to secondary school, high school, they didn't read nearly as much, if at all. They didn't read the books and stuff. And we felt one component of that, the one that really struck me, was that one rung of the ladder had disappeared almost, and that was comics. When I was growing up, comics were cheap literacy, and they were an important early rung on that ladder that would take you to the next stage. You know, you could, D.C. Thompson, the publishing house in Dundee, would put out war comics, Commando, the Victor, the Hotspur. They were all kind of gung-ho stories about football and stories about spacemen and stories about the army and all the rest of it. And there were all these kind of young boys like me who would sort of pass these comics around, and they were easily affordable, they were just a few pennies a week. And you got into the rhythm of actually reading, and you got into the rhythm of that then firing your imagination and taking to the next step, which would be books, and you would get into novels after that. And that rung of the ladder has pretty much disappeared, that people don't seem to read. I mean, there's still things like Batman and Superman. There are sort of comics around, but they're not immediately available on the shelves of newsagents in a way that they used to be for that age group. But, of course, literacy is still around. It's just a different kind of literacy. I mean, every time somebody, sends a text message or goes on Twitter or goes on Facebook, they are actually communicating with the written word. So there's still a lot of it going on. And whenever anybody listens to the lyric of a song and thinks about the lyrics of a song or looks up the lyrics of a song online, they're looking at poetry. You know, I mean, a lot of people don't realise that the song lyrics, the rhythm, the scansion, the rhyme, everything else, these are latter-day poems. So there's still plenty of literacy out there. It's just a kind of changing literacy. But I do worry that, especially with young men, there's a rung of the ladder that's missing there that never used to be missing, and it makes it harder to get to the next step up. And as someone who makes his living from books, from writing books and selling books, I mean, it's very important to me that the next generation of readers of novels comes along and is nurtured and is enthused by stories the way that I was when I was younger.
And just finally for me, I just wonder what your aspirations are for the young people of Scotland, you know, within sort of wider changes within society. both in terms of literacy, but just in general, what are your hopes for the young people in the future?
Well, I mean, I've got a lot of, you know, I get a lot of positive messages from the young people that I meet. People that have become kind of socially engaged, have become politically engaged. I mean, my own son, you know, joined a political party for the first time last year because he was energised by the independence referendum. And that was something he hadn't shown much interest in before the referendum got going. So that was very exciting to me. And, I mean, I do think that, you know, when I see sort of folk going to college and university now, it seems to me they're working harder than ever. I mean, I was pretty lazy when I was at uni in the late 70s. And, I mean, I got all the benefits that were available. I got a full grant. You know, I was getting £300 a term for a 10-week term. That was £30 a week. And that would pay for your rent and your, you know, your accommodation, your bills, and give you plenty left over for buying records and books and going to the pub and everything else. And, you know, there was no tuition fees. There was none of that. Everything was kind of given to you. And that was really important because coming from the background I did, my parents would have been horrified at the notion of debt. They never had debt in their life. They never owned a credit card. You know, they saved up to buy things. Once they'd saved up enough, they could buy a colour telly. Once they'd saved up enough, they could buy a washing machine. So the notion that the son would come out of higher education owing tens of thousands of pounds would have been anathema to them. And in that case, probably anathema to me as well. So it might have actually stymied me going. So, I mean, I've got a lot of respect for young people who go into higher education now, knowing that's kind of hanging over them and knowing that they're being told to work harder than ever and getting less help because, of course, the staff cutbacks, staff have been asked to work harder. There isn't the kind of one-on-one kind of help that you used to get. Tutorial groups have pretty much disappeared now. It's more kind of seminars and lectures. And so you're having to be more self-motivated. You're not getting the help you used to get. You're not getting led by the hand. And I'm afraid for some people it will be sink or swim. Some people will be lost to that and they'll have a hard time coping with it. But hopefully at the end you come out stronger and you come out and you're a survivor and I think you'll come out a better human being. So I do have a lot of hope for the future and for the people who are going to be looking after me when I'm in my dotage.
And before we get to that, Ian, one of the things that came through was that aspirations change and evolve through time. What about for yourself? What are your own aspirations? Obviously, accomplished author, well-known Scottish figurehead within literature circles and beyond. What are your own aspirations now?
Well, I mean, I've kind of, you know, in terms of my professional life, I've pretty much covered all the bases. I've done what I wanted to do. I mean, I've become a very successful author without really having to change the kinds of books I wanted to write. You know, I'm still writing the kinds of books I always wanted to write. I haven't had to pander to commerce. I've managed to sort of make a success despite writing books about Scotland. I mean, who would have thought that people in Korea, I mean, just today I got a package of books translated into Korean from Seoul in South Korea. Who would have thought folk would be sitting in Seoul, South Korea, interested in what's happening in contemporary Scotland? So that's been a real buzz. That's been a real thrill. And for the future, you know, you hope you don't leave behind a world that was worse than when you came into it. And I'm afraid that my generation don't seem to have been doing a very good job of that so far. So it'll be up to the generations after us to clear up our mess, alas.
Ian, thank you so much for taking time out this evening to join us on Radio Edutalk and best wishes for the future.
Yeah, thank you, guys. Take care.
OK, take care. Bye now.